Blog Talk Radio.
Capital Markets Today, where industry experts discuss capital markets, trading, real estate, and mortgage lending, is brought to you by Neighborhood Stabilization Capital Management, where private, nonprofit, and public collaboration are providing industry and social solutions as well as investor returns. Please visit www.nscm.us and learn more. Now your host of Capital Markets Today, Louis Amaya.
Welcome to Capital Markets Today and the DDC Financial Series of European Investment Forum podcast. Capital Markets Today listeners can use code NSCM30 for a 30% discount to the European Investment Summit being held in Miami, Florida, USA on March 8th and 9th, 2017. Alternative investment manager CVC Credit Partners recently closed its new distressed credit fund that will focus predominantly on European opportunities, raising a total of 2.5 billion euro for the strategy. The new fund, named the Global Special Situations Fund, receives strong backing from both new and existing investors. Investors from North America, Latin America, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East are participating in the fund. Partners at the fund believe the structural changes across the European banking landscape, potentially impacted by Brexit, have created attractive investment opportunities across the European landscape. Joining the podcast to discuss the European distressed investment environment is Stacey Schachter, CEO of Vion Investments. Vion is a global buyer of consumer and commercial receivables and also offers alternative receivable lending solutions and portfolio appraisals. The European investment environment, up next on Capital Markets Today.
This podcast is brought to you by NS Capital Management. NS Capital Management supports the acquisition and management efforts of various investment funds in the residential debt and real estate asset classes. NS Capital Management offers its partners transparent portfolio management methodologies, fund administration, proprietary technology, in-house REO management, and unique NPL acquisition channels. Visit NS Capital Management on the web at www.nscm.us.
Stacey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Before we get started, can you provide us a little bit of background on Vion and how you got started and where you primarily operate?
Sure thing. I started Vion myself in 2008 with some backing from a private equity group in New York. And our focus when we started in 2008 was really distressed types of receivables, distressed investing. I wish I could say that I knew the markets were going to crash and that all this doom and gloom was going to happen, but I think it just was really right place at the right time. And because we had a well-funded sponsor with locked-up money, we were effectively off to the races almost as soon as we started. So we were, we bought a bank from the FDIC, and we were buying all sorts of receivables all over the place. And as I like to tell people, if you're a Clint Eastwood fan, we buy the good, the bad, and the ugly, from performing all the way down to charge-off, both on the commercial side and on the consumer side. And while we started off domestically, we did expand into Canada, the UK, Spain, Italy, Europe generally, as well as a couple other areas. So we grew fast, but in part we grew fast just because the market allowed it.
So you launched in, say, 2008, is that correct?
That's correct.
So how have the markets been changing since then? I mean, as you mentioned, the timing's perfect. But as the environment continued to evolve and we've seen, recent changes in Europe, how are the markets changing and what are the opportunities in Europe at this point in time?
Well, it's interesting because it used to be things would move, regardless of whether it was Europe or in the U.S., at a relatively modest pace. So when we were buying things in the U.S., it took, you know, 2 or 3 years for people to come back into the space. And there was a lot of money out there. They were just, it was afraid, and so it didn't come back in. But it was just sort of sitting on the sidelines, and then when it came in, it really poured in. That, coupled with technology, allowed things to effectively mature a lot faster. So you can take a look, a perfect example, I'm going to start off in the U.S., but it applies to Europe, and so I'll get there. But in the U.S., there were hundreds, if not thousands, of bad debt buyers. And due to several factors, one being just availability of cash, two, regulation from places like the OCC and later on the CFPB, the FTC, et cetera, those thousands of players quickly consolidated. And you see consolidation in all sorts of markets whenever you're looking for efficiencies, and you need those efficiencies if there's, frankly, not enough supply and too much demand. So when that happened, we saw a quick escalation in prices. We saw a commoditization of the space, and that commoditization resulted in, frankly, a lot of firms having to retool and go. Some just went out of business. Some had to find other things to do, other niches to fill. And the reason I say this is really relevant to Europe is we were one of the first people to jump into Spain during their banking crisis. And the markets there were relatively inefficient, but thanks to firms like KPMG and others who really brought some sophistication to the space and brought lenders there up very quickly on the learning curve on how to properly market their assets. The time from sort of beginning of the debt buying cycle to maturity was probably one-third of what we saw in the U.S. Bad debt buying in the U.S. has been going on for decades, but it didn't. When it started maturing, it matured really fast. And you can take a look at other countries in Europe and say the same thing is sort of happening. The U.K. matured very, very quickly, way before Spain did. And so people were always searching for yield. And so when they started looking for yield, and I'm going to break out different asset classes here. You know, I'm going to distinguish real estate from non-real estate. There's still a lot of buying going on in the real estate space in Spain and other parts of Western and Southern Europe. But as the markets, you know, began cutting back on some of those returns, people started looking to places like Italy. And we went to Italy as well. We've gone to Central and Eastern Europe. But you can look at places like Poland, which has a lot of sophistication and a mature market. We've been looking at places like Romania and Slovakia and some of these other countries that still, while there's some better returns there, are maturing quickly. And that's because the sophisticated buyers are the same people that the same people that went to the UK, went to Spain, went to Italy, and they brought all this wealth of knowledge and information on how to do the business. So it really comes down to, can the country involved, does the banking system there, for example, have the sophistication to handle the demands and the needs of the buyers? But very quickly, buyer markets are changing into seller markets. So I apologize if that was a bit long-winded, but I felt a bit of background was needed to answer that question.
No, that's very interesting. The sophistication of, for example, the U.S. market provides for liquidity and reduces the risk, but also the yields. Are you seeing, but you're saying in some parts of Europe, the yields are still, say, greater than as if it was not as mature market, but the market is maturing quicker than the yields are being impacted?
Yes, that's correct. And it depends on the level of sophistication needed to go into that market. So if you have somebody who's looking to do real estate, for example, there's a certain amount of sophistication involved in that versus non-real estate, which I think is, frankly, if you're talking about consumer credit, is a little easier to get up to speed on than, let's say, SME or commercial. as opposed to large cap commercial, buying bad loans from banks. Each one of those categories requires a certain level of sophistication, but some are, frankly, I think, a little easier to grasp than others. So as you go into these countries, it's sort of like, how do you diligence it? One of the problems we have, and the reason I don't really spend a lot of time talking about places like Slovakia and all that, is volume. For us, and given the size that we are, the size deals that we need, frankly, the country just has to be big enough to support the demand that we and others would have. And so a lot of people can talk about Portugal, for example, but Portugal just doesn't have the volume of paper available compared to Spain, Italy, UK. Germany is another very mature market. People, have been looking at Romania and Hungary as having sort of critical mass of product availability. It sort of depends on what scale you're looking for.
So when you go into a particular market in Europe, every country is different. They have different laws and legal system. Are you hiring local operators to work the portfolio? And how do you deal with, the differences in legality through the different countries?
Yeah, so other different people do things different ways. A lot of people like to go, and if they're going to go into a country, they may make that full, jump in the water commitment, and they're looking to acquire servicers. And so you saw a lot of servicer acquisitions in Spain. You see it in Italy. You see it in Poland and other areas, where a lot of the independent servicers or collection agencies are being acquired by the debt buyers themselves, because they're looking to get that lower cost and efficiencies, but also to gain knowledge. We follow a bit of a different strategy, and that's because we like the flexibility of being able to move from sector to sector as pricing dictates. So when pricing in Spain moved up, since we didn't have that type of overhead associated with it, it was sort of easy for us just to pick up our tent and move it over to Italy, because we just didn't have a lot of boots on the ground, so to say. There's pros and cons to that, but ideally, we believe in an outsource strategy. And so by that, we like to partner with smart servicers in country, hopefully in a JV basis, but if not, just on a pure employment basis, to go and acquire the paper. We can't, and I certainly wouldn't recommend for anybody else to go into a country without doing a fair amount of diligence on that country and their culture, etc. So as we go into a country, we're partnering up with lawyers who are educating us, accountants, on how we need to worry about how things are provisioned, etc. And we try to be thoughtful about how we approach any particular market, because it doesn't matter how much time you spend in a country, unless you're born and have lived there, you just won't pick up on the nuances. And those nuances can kill you. So that's why we really want to partner with a servicer that's in country that has been doing it for a while. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, how do you find these partners through relationships, or because I've spoken to many that went the other route and indicated that they'll buy a local servicer because they want to be in that space, and the reason was being if you use an outsourced servicer, they're captive by someone else who's an investor, and they may not give you the time or the attention you would need as compared to their captive holder. But it sounds like you've resolve that issue by one, finding the right partner, and two, entering into some type of JV on the deal with them when you acquire?
Correct. So, but what those people are telling you is absolutely correct. And there is a lot of pros for going in and acquiring that servicer if you think you're going to be in that country for a lot of years, and you think that servicing entity is going to be accretive to you. So you buy that entity, you build it up, Maybe it had 200 seats and you build it up to 400 seats, for example. All of that helps increase the value of the underlying platform, so to say. We don't view ourselves as platform buyers, and we don't necessarily buy into the thesis that a platform actually provides incremental value. We believe, and if you take a look at U.S. publicly traded companies, people were giving some of those companies a platform value and platform valuations. Since then, those valuations have changed a great deal, where those platforms tend to be valued at the basically the value of the underlying portfolio. So why have all that overhead that, you go into that country, you're making a commitment to that country, but it's also an anchor or a chain to that country. And as market conditions change, you can be left, basically having to feed the beast and take lower returns. In terms of how we go about finding a servicer, if there was a servicer that was, let's say, partnered with one of our, I don't even say competitors, it would just be partnered with somebody else who they have a sort of serious relationship with, then we probably would not work with that servicer. We're looking for servicers that are truly independent. They do not necessarily need to work only for us. They can work for others, but we certainly don't want them to be owned by competitors. And finding those is sometimes not easy, but we work a lot with attorneys that are in country, accountants that are in country, and other advisors who tend to really know who the good servicers are and puts us in touch with those servicers, and then we work with them on a more, a more partner-like basis, where we're not just looking at them as a vendor, we do look at them as a partner.
And what about the asset management or the oversight? Do you do that in-house as a manager, or are you outsourcing the oversight as well, or is there no kind of middle asset management platform?
No, we normally do the oversight in-house. So that part, we feel that part is critical to keep under our roof. Even when it comes to analytics, we look to the servicer to take a look at a portfolio, for example, give us some analytics on that portfolio. But we'll do our own independent analytics based on data that we have, and then we'll compare the two, see where there's differences, and then talk with our partner or slash servicer to understand why there's differences so that we can harmonize between the two. So the people I like to have under my roof are the people that are sort of core to the success of the business, being not necessarily the collectors, but being the people who analyze the analyst and the legal folks, so that we're really more like a master servicer than anything else.
Got it. And what about the cultural differences? I know throughout Europe, I mean, obviously Europe is very different from the U.S., and different parts of Europe are different from each other. How does that play into your ability to execute on your strategy?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I mentioned earlier how important culture is, and you have to understand how you collect or service within that culture. And I say service because we do get involved with performing assets as much as non-performing. And what's really interesting is culturally, as you take a look at a country like Spain or a country like Italy, and I'm using those two because those seem to be the two hottest areas that I think your audience might be involved in. And you can say, well, the culture in southern Spain or southern Italy is very different from the culture in, let's say, central Spain or northern Italy, and requires a different type of touch. Even within the U.S., if I'm, let's say I'm trying to collect something in Puerto Rico. I'm generally going to want to do that with collectors based in Puerto Rico. And that's because they will understand the culture in Puerto Rico. They'll understand the how to speak to somebody so that you don't end up offending somebody in a particular way. So there's two cultural issues you have to deal with. One is with the account debtor. How is that account debtor being approached, and do they take offense? I know there are some companies that will collect, for example, in Italy, but they might be based in Spain, or they might be based elsewhere. And that's it's to save money, save cost, but you will lose some collections, and that's because of a lack of understanding of that local culture. Now, it still may pay off, by the way. I'm not saying it's a bad strategy. You may collect less, but your expenses may be so much lower that it makes perfect sense to do that, and I understand the rationale for it. But I generally like to use attorneys within the local region, to use collectors or servicers within the local region for any given population. Now, that's on the account debtor side. But there's cultural issues, too, in dealing with your own partners and understanding when they say something, what that means, and when you say something, how that's interpreted. And that's far harder to do. And what we do is just, we just try and spend a lot of time with our servicer initially. We spend a lot of time over the phone. We go in the country. We visit. And we try and learn. And I can't tell you how invaluable it is just to sit down around the table and break bread and not even talk business, just to understand somebody else's life. And when you understand their life, it gives you a view, a window into the culture of not only that person, but of that particular country. You know, heritage is really important, and I think people make a mistake if they discount it and think that everything is based on a spreadsheet that they have in front of them. It's so much more than that.
You know, that's a really interesting statement. I wasn't even thinking about the cultural differences between your partners and how that could impact your business. I was thinking more of the collection activity. So that's a really good point. And two, I've dealt with investors who were traders and were very good at managing money and trades, but not necessarily the relationships and the people that it takes to build a business. So you're absolutely correct in that sense that the understanding of your partners and what makes them tick is incredibly important. So that's a great point. Where do you see the risks, macro and micro, in the next, say, 18 months as people start to look more into Europe because of the opportunities that are presenting themselves?
So macro risk, I don't even know anymore sometimes. I've been so surprised from Brexit, which I think nobody thought would happen, to the election of Donald Trump. And you've got Donald Trump, who's becoming very insular, who wants to break these various trade agreements, the Fed raising interest rates, and all these things ripple across the world. You have Japan's economy that is finally growing. You have China's economy, which might be stalling. There's so much going on right now. To me, there seems like there should be a lot more volatility, a lot more angst in the economic cycles. Yet you still see the U.S.'s stock markets hitting all-time highs every single day. To me, I think there's an extreme risk of reversal here. And I'm using those terms because that's more of that's a stock market type term to say extreme risk. But whenever you see such a bullish streak, whether it be the Dow or other components in an economy, it seems overheated. And we've seen these overheated cycles before, and when they really come down, they come down hard. Now, the people will say that the reason that the U.S. economy is doing so well is because they believe Donald Trump can remove a lot of regulation, and that regulation is going to benefit companies. But at the same time, he's talking about putting on tariffs, and nobody really knows what to expect from him. He's an unknown quantity, and I just don't know what to make of him yet. When we look at Brexit and the impact there, you've got Theresa May, who says different things at different times, and it's like, is it going to be a soft landing or is it going to be a hard exit? And all these things bring concern to me that there can be at least some negative impact on world economies, and Europe is still particularly fragile. You know, Italy is financially in trouble. France is in trouble. You can look at Germany, who's been bearing the burden of a lot of Europe, but yet you have lots of bright spots, and you do have economies, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, that have really picked up and seem to be doing quite well. And so whereas before I used to make pronouncements on macro conditions, I'm just at a total loss now, and I look at what the economists had predicted, you know, just looking 12 months out, and most of the time, those people who have been educated in how to do it have just been wrong. Right. So when we look at macro issues, which I think is really important, you have to say, well, if there's uncertainty, it's a matter of what's your risk appetite. And when I tend to be a little more of a contrarian, and when I see markets really going up, I'm saying, oh, they're going to be coming down, and I want to be there with liquidity when they do. So that's a little bit of my macro view, but we've always been very opportunistic buyers. And even in terrific markets, you can find companies that are in distress or that need your help. And so our expertise is ferreting out those companies, ferreting out those opportunities, and still being able to deploy capital in a, let's say, a lower risk way in what I'm perceiving to be perhaps a higher risk environment. On the micro level, micro in the sense that I take a look at individual countries like Italy, and when we talk about micro, I mentioned earlier you have northern Italy and you have southern Italy. And southern Italy isn't doing that well compared to northern Italy. So when you're going into a country and you look into its regions, you can't just look at numbers and say, well, these are the numbers for Spain, these are the numbers for Germany, these are the numbers for Slovakia. You have to understand what the numbers are in the areas that you're concerned with. And really, you got to get into the details. Don't just stop with it, you know, talking about or looking at a particular country's growth rate or, you know, the troubles that the banks have. When you know that, well, there's more banks that are in trouble in southern Italy than northern Italy, for example, if that's the case. And by the way, I don't know if that's the case. I'm making that up. But I'm just using that as an example of you've got to get granular in your analysis. And if you fail to do that, you may not get what you bargained for.
Interesting. It's fascinating. I know time's just about up, and I just wanted to get your closing thoughts on where your focus in Europe is going to be over the next 12 months. Is there any particular area that you see, you know, greater opportunity than others?
Well, I think there's still better opportunities in Central and Eastern Europe. Whether that is going to be our focus or not, I can't really say. I think generically speaking, people who I know that are my competitors, who are also my friends, we'll call them frenemies, are putting a lot more focus into Central and Eastern Europe, places like Hungary and Romania, and I've mentioned a lot of these countries already, Slovakia, countries that have enough, at least paper, to make it interesting. Our focus has always been global in nature. Right now, we've been getting some deals from Poland, deals from Italy, and surprisingly, a few deals back now in the UK. But our primary focus is still probably within the U.S. because there's still a fair amount of distress in the U.S. in certain sectors, which is one other, I guess, macro issue is that, you know, you can have the country, any country can be doing great, but still have particular sectors that are in trouble. And certainly in the U.S., for example, you could say, well, the oil and gas sector until recently has been very troubled and you can say the same about oil and gas, and probably any country that has that type of Canada is another example that, you know, was struggling because of oil and gas issues. And you can look at where the Canadian dollar was to the U.S. dollar, let's say 2 years ago versus where it is now, and that is in large part because Canada relies so much on natural resources. So when I look at opportunities, I really want to find, I don't care where they are, to be honest. I don't really care. I'm going to be looking at those countries where I feel they have a good, sound legal system. Because if they don't have a legal system you can trust to enforce your agreements, then I just don't get involved in that country. So there are some countries that I would say are on our blacklist, and I don't want to mention any of them because I don't want people to get mad at me. But I could tell, it's easier for me to tell you the countries I won't be in as opposed to the countries that I will be in. I will tell you I won't be in Russia. And I know I do have some friends that are Russian debt buyers, but given the what's going on, at least in the U.S., with respect to U.S.-Russia relations and other things, at least for now, I would say Russia is certainly not a good place for us at this time.
Well, excellent. This has been great information. And you'll be at the, I believe you're speaking at the European Investment Summit in coming up next month on the 8th and 9th. So I'll see you out there and look forward to talking some more.
Oh, great. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stacey. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
That wraps up today's podcast. Please subscribe to the Capital Markets Today on iTunes and have every podcast available to you on your smartphone as soon as it is published. For more information on capital markets and the mortgage and real estate industry, join the Capital Markets Today group on LinkedIn. Today's show is brought to you by NS Capital Management, extracting value through effective asset management. You can find NS Capital Management on the web at www.nscm.us. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time.
Capital Markets Today is a leading industry content provider. Please visit Capital Markets Today at www.capital-mt.com for industry data, downloads, news, blogs, and to listen on demand to all past podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to Capital Markets Today on iTunes to have the latest podcasts downloaded to your smartphone automatically, giving you the flexibility to listen at your convenience.